see the travelers. They stood around like cut-out cardboard figures and asked, "Well, how was it up north? See any of them big buildings? Ever ride in one of them elevators? Was you scared? White folks any different, like they say?" Bailey took it upon himself to answer every question, and from a corner of his lively imagination wove a tapestry of entertainment for them that I was sure was as foreign to him as it was to me. He, as usual, spoke precisely. "They have, in the north, buildings so high that for months in the winter you can't see the top floors. Tell the truth, they've got watermelons twice the size of a cow's head and sweeter than syrup." I distinctly remember his intent face and the fascinated faces of his listeners. "And if you can count the watermelon seeds before it's cut open, you can win $5 zillion and a new car." Mama, knowing Bailey, warned, "Now, Jew, be careful you don't slip on a not true." Nice people didn't say lie. "Everybody wears new clothes and have inside toilets. If you fall down in one of them, you get flushed away into the Mississippi River. Some people have ice boxes, only the proper name is cold spot or frigidaire. The snow is so deep, you can get buried right outside your door, and people won't find you for a year. We made ice cream out of the snow." That was the only fact that I could have supported. "During the winter, we had collected a bowl of snow and poured pet milk over it and sprinkled it with sugar and called it ice cream." Mama beamed, and Uncle Willie was proud when Bailey regaled the customers with our exploits. We were drawing cards for the store and objects of the town's adoration. Our journey to magical places alone was a spot of color on the town's drab canvas, and our return made us even more the most enviable of people. High spots in stamps were usually negative: droughts, floods, lynchings, and deaths. Bailey played on the country folks' need for diversion. Just after our return, he had taken to sarcasm, picked it up as one might pick up a stone, and put it snuff-like under his lip. The double entendres, the two-pronged sentences, slid over his tongue to dart, rapier-like, into anything that happened to be in the way. Our customers, though, generally, were so straight-thinking and speaking that they were never hurt by his attacks. They didn't comprehend them. "Bailey Jr. sound just like Big Bailey. Got a silver tongue just like his daddy. I hear tell they don't pick cotton up there. How do people live then?" Bailey said that the cotton up north was so tall, if ordinary people tried to pick it, they'd have to get up on ladders. So the cotton farmers had their cotton picked by machines. For a while, I was the only recipient of Bailey's kindness. It was not that he pitied me, but that he felt we were in the same boat for different reasons, and that I could understand his frustration, just as he could countenance my withdrawal. I never knew if Uncle Willie had been told about the incident in St. Louis, but sometimes I caught him watching me with a far-off look in his big eyes. Then he would quickly send me on some errand that would take me out of his presence. When that happened, I was both relieved and ashamed. I certainly didn't want a cripple's sympathy. That would have been the case of the blind leading the blind. Nor did I want Uncle Willie, whom I loved in my fashion, to think of me as being sinful and dirty. If he thought so, at least I didn't want to know it. Sounds came to me dully, as if people were speaking through their handkerchiefs or with their hands over their mouths. Colors weren't true either, but rather a vague assortment of shaded pastels that indicated not so much color as faded familiarities. People's names escaped me, and I began to worry over my sanity. After all, we had been away less than a year, and customers, whose accounts I had formerly remembered without consulting the ledger, were now complete strangers. People, except Mama and Uncle Willie, accepted my unwillingness to talk as a natural outgrowth of a reluctant return to the South, and an indication that I was pining for the high times we had had in the big city. Then, too, I was well known for being tenderhearted. Southern Negroes used that term to mean sensitive, and tended to look upon a person with that affliction as being a little sick or in delicate health. So I was not so much forgiven as I was understood. 15. For nearly a year, I sopped around the house, the store, the school, and the church like an old biscuit, dirty and inedible. Then I met, or rather got to know, the lady who threw me my first lifeline. Mrs. Bertha Flowers was the aristocrat of black stamps. She had the grace of control to appear warm in the coldest weather. And on the Arkansas summer days, it seemed she had a private breeze which swirled around, cooling her. She was thin, without the taut look of wiry people, and her printed voile dresses and flowered hats were as right for her as denim overalls for a farmer. She was our side's answer to the richest white woman in town. Her skin was a rich black that would have peeled like a plum if snagged, but then no one would have thought of getting close enough to Mrs. Flowers to ruffle her dress, let alone snag her skin. She didn't encourage familiarity. She wore gloves, too. I don't think I ever saw Mrs. Flowers laugh, but she smiled often, a slow widening of her thin, black lips to show even small white teeth, then the slow, effortless closing. When she chose to smile on me, I always wanted to thank her. The action was so graceful and inclusively benign. She was one of the few gentlewomen I have ever known, and has remained throughout my life the measure of what a human being can be. Mama had a strange relationship with her. Most often when she passed on the road in front of the store, she spoke to Mama in that soft yet carrying voice. "Good day, Mrs. Henderson." Mama responded with, "How you, Sister Flowers?" Mrs. Flowers didn't belong to our church, nor was she Mama's familiar. Why on earth did she insist on calling her Sister Flowers? Shame made me want to hide my face. Mrs. Flowers deserved better than to be called sister. Then Mama left out the verb. Why not ask, "How are you, Mrs. Flowers?" With the unbalanced passion of the young, I hated her for showing her ignorance to Mrs. Flowers. It didn't occur to me for many years that they were as alike as sisters, separated only by formal education. Although I was upset, neither of the women was in the least shaken by what I thought an unceremonious greeting. Mrs. Flowers would continue her easy gait up the hill to her little bungalow, and Mama kept on shelling peas or doing whatever had brought her to the front porch. Occasionally, though, Mrs. Flowers would drift off the road and down to the store, and Mama would say to me, "Sister, you go on and play." As I left, I would hear the beginning of an intimate conversation, Mama persistently using the wrong verb, or none at all. "Brother and Sister Wilcox is surely the meanest." "Is, Mama? Is? Oh, please, not is, Mama, for two or more. But they talked, and from the side of the building where I waited for the ground to open up and swallow me, I heard the soft-voiced Mrs. Flowers and the textured voice of my grandmother merging and melting. They were interrupted from time to time by giggles that must have come from Mrs. Flowers. Mama never giggled in her life. Then she was gone. She appealed to me because she was like people I had never met personally, like women in English novels who walked the moors, whatever they were, with their loyal dogs racing at a respectful distance, like the women who sat in front of roaring fireplaces, drinking tea incessantly from silver trays full of scones and crumpets, women who walked over the heath and read Morocco-bound books and had two last names divided by a hyphen. It would be safe to say that she made me proud to be Negro just by being herself. She acted just as refined as white folks in the movies and books, and she was more beautiful, for none of them could have come near that warm color without looking gray by comparison. It was fortunate that I never saw her in the company of poor white folks, for since they tend to think of their whiteness as an evenizer, I'm certain I would have had to hear her spoken to commonly as Bertha, and my image of her would have been shattered like the unmendable Humpty Dumpty. One summer afternoon, sweet milk fresh in my memory, she stopped at the store to buy provisions. Another Negro woman of her health and age would have been expected to carry the paper sacks home in one hand. But Mama said, "Sister Flowers, I'll send Bailey up to your house with these things." She smiled that slow, dragging smile. "Thank you, Mrs. Henderson. I'd prefer Marguerite, though." My name was beautiful when she said it. I'd been meaning to talk to her anyway. They gave each other age group looks. Mother said, "Well, that's all right then. Sister, go and change your dress. You're going to Sister Flowers." The chiffon robe was a maze. What on earth did one put on to go to Mrs. Flowers' house? I knew I shouldn't put on a Sunday dress. It might be sacrilegious. Certainly not a house dress, since I was already wearing a fresh one. I chose a school dress, naturally. It was formal, without suggesting that going to Mrs. Flowers' house was equivalent to attending church. I trusted myself back into the store. "Now, don't you look nice?" I had chosen the right thing for once. "Mrs. Henderson, you make most of the children's clothes, don't you?" "Yes, ma'am, sure do. Store-bought clothes ain't hardly worth the thread it take to stitch them. I'll say you do a lovely job, though. So neat. That dress looks professional." Mama was enjoying the seldom received compliments, since everyone we knew, except Mrs. Flowers, of course, could sew competently. Praise was rarely handed out for the commonly practiced craft. "I try, with the help of the Lord, Sister Flowers, to finish the inside just like I does the outside. Come here, sister." I had buttoned up the collar and tied the belt apron-like in back. Mama told me to turn around. With one hand, she pulled the strings, and the belt fell free at both sides of my waist. Then her large hands were at my neck, opening the button loops. I was terrified. What was happening? "Take it off, sister." She had her hands on the hem of the dress. "I don't need to see the inside, Mrs. Henderson. I can tell." But the dress was over my head, and my arms were stuck in the sleeves. Mama said, "That'll do. See here, Sister Flowers, I French seams around the armholes." Through the cloth film, I saw the shadow approach. "That makes it last longer. Children these days would bust out of sheet metal clothes, they're so rough." That is a very good job, Mrs. Henderson. You should be proud. You can put your dress back on, Marguerite. No, ma'am, pride is a sin, and according to the good book, it goeth before a fall. That's right. So the Bible says. It's a good thing to keep in mind. I wouldn't look at either of them. Mama hadn't thought that taking off my dress in front of Mrs. Flowers would kill me stone dead. If I had refused, she would have thought I was trying to be womanish and might have remembered St. Louis. Mrs. Flowers had known that I would be embarrassed, and that was even worse. I picked up the groceries and went out to wait in the hot sunshine. It would be fitting if I got a sunstroke and died before they came outside, just dropped dead on the slanting porch. There was a little path beside the rocky road, and Mrs. Flowers walked in front, swinging her arms and picking her way over the stones. She said without turning her head to me, "I hear you're doing very good schoolwork, Marguerite, but that's all written. The teachers report that they have trouble getting you to talk in class." We passed the triangular farm on our left, and the path widened to allow us to walk together. I hung back in the separate, unasked and unanswerable questions. "Come and walk along with me, Marguerite." I couldn't have refused even if I wanted to. She pronounced my name so nicely. Or, more correctly, she spoke each word with such clarity that I was certain a foreigner who didn't understand English could have understood her. "Now, no one is going to make you talk. Possibly no one can. But bear in mind, language is man's way of communicating with his fellow man. And it is language alone which separates him from the lower animals." That was a totally new idea to me, and I would need time to think about it. "Your grandmother says you read a lot, every chance you get. That's good, but not good enough. Words mean more than what is set down on paper. It takes the human voice to infuse them with the shades of deeper meaning." I memorized the part about the human voice infusing words. It seemed so valid and poetic. She said she was going to give me some books, and that I not only must read them, I must read them aloud. She suggested that I try to make a sentence sound in as many different ways as possible. "I'll accept no excuse if you return a book to me that has been badly handled." My imagination boggled at the punishment I would deserve if, in fact, I did abuse a book of Mrs. Flowers. Death would be too kind and brief. The odors in the house surprised me. Somehow, I had never connected Mrs. Flowers with food or eating or any other common experience of common people. There must have been an outhouse, too, but my mind never recorded it. The sweet scent of vanilla had met us as she opened the door. "I made tea cookies this morning. You see, I had planned to invite you for cookies and lemonade so we could have this little chat. The lemonade is in the icebox." It followed that Mrs. Flowers would have ice on an ordinary day, when most families in our town bought ice late on Saturdays, only a few times during the summer, to be used in the wooden ice cream freezers. She took the bags from me and disappeared through the kitchen door. I looked around the room that I had never in my wildest fantasies imagined I would see. Browned photographs leered or threatened from the walls, and the white, freshly done curtains pushed against themselves and against the wind. I wanted to gobble up the entire room and take it to Bailey, who would help me analyze and enjoy it. "Have a seat, Marguerite, over there by the table." She carried a platter covered with a tea towel. Although she warned that she hadn't tried her hand at baking sweets for some time. I was certain that, like everything else about her, the cookies would be perfect. They were flat, round wafers, slightly browned on the edges and butter yellow in the center. With the cold lemonade, they were sufficient for childhood's lifelong diet. Remembering my manners, I took nice little ladylike bites off the edges. She said she had made them expressly for me, and that she had a few in the kitchen that I could take home to my brother. So I jammed one whole cake in my mouth, and the rough crumbs scratched the insides of my jaws. And if I hadn't had to swallow, it would have been a dream come true. As I ate, she began the first of what we later called my lessons in living. She said that I must always be intolerant of ignorance, but understanding of illiteracy. That some people, unable to go to school, were more educated and even more intelligent than college professors. She encouraged me to listen carefully to what country people called mother wit, that in those homely sayings was couched the collective wisdom of generations. When I finished the cookies, she brushed off the table and brought a thick, small book from the bookcase. I had read A Tale of Two Cities and found it up to my standards as a romantic novel. She opened the first page, and I heard poetry for the first time in my life. It was the best of time and the worst of times. Her voice slid in and curved down through and over the words. She was nearly singing. I wanted to look at the pages. Were they the same that I had read? Or were there notes, music, lined on the pages, as in a hymn book? Her sounds began cascading gently. I knew from listening to 1,000 preachers that she was nearing the end of her reading, and I hadn't really heard to understand a single word. How do you like that? It occurred to me that she expected a response. The sweet vanilla flavor was still on my tongue, and her reading was a wonder in my ears. I had to speak. I said, "Yes, ma'am." It was the least I could do, but it was the most also. "There's one more thing. Take this book of poems and memorize one for me. Next time you pay me a visit, I want you to recite." I have tried often to search behind the sophistication of years for the enchantment I so easily found in those gifts. The essence escapes, but its aura remains. To be allowed, no, invited, into the private lives of strangers, and to share their joys and fears, was a chance to exchange the southern bitter wormwood for a cup of mead with Beowulf, or a hot cup of tea and milk with Oliver Twist. When I said aloud, "It is a far, far better thing that I do than I have ever done," tears of love filled my eyes at my selflessness. On that first day, I ran down the hill and into the road. Few cars ever came along it, and had the good sense to stop running before I reached the store. I was liked, and what a difference it made. I was respected, not as Mrs. Henderson's grandchild, or Bailey's sister, but for just being Marguerite Johnson. Childhood's logic never asked to be proved. All conclusions are absolute. I didn't question why Mrs. Flowers had singled me out for attention, nor did it occur to me that Mama might have asked her to give me a little talking to. All I cared about was that she had made tea cookies for me and read to me from her favorite book. It was enough to prove that she liked me. Mama and Bailey were waiting inside the store. He said, "My, what did she give you?" He had seen the books, but I held the paper sack with his cookies in my arms, shielded by the poems. Mama said, "Sister, I know you acted like a little lady. That do my heart good to see settled people take to you all. I'm trying my best, the Lord knows, but these days..." Her voice trailed off. "Go on in and change your dress." In the bedroom, it was going to be a joy to see Bailey receive his cookies. I said, "By the way, Bailey, Mrs. Flowers sent you some tea cookies." My grandmother shouted, "What did you say, sister? You sister, what did you say?" Hot anger was crackling in her voice. Bailey said, "She said Mrs. Flowers sent me some. I ain't talking to you, Jew." I heard the heavy feet walk across the floor toward our bedroom. "Sister, you heard me. What's that you said?" She swelled to fill the doorway. Bailey said, "Mama?" His pacifying voice. "Mama, she..." "You shut up, Jew. I'm talking to your sister." I didn't know what sacred cow I had bumped, but it was better to find out than to hang like a thread over an open fire. I repeated, "I said, Bailey, by the way, Mrs. Flowers sent you..." "That's what I thought you said. Go on and take off your dress. I'm going to get a switch." At first, I thought she was playing. Maybe some heavy joke that would end with, "You sure she didn't send me something?" But in a minute, she was back in the room with a long, ropey peach tree switch, the juice smelling bitter at having been torn loose. She said, "Get down on your knees, Bailey Jr. You come on, too." The three of us knelt as she began. "Our Father, you know the tribulations of your humble servant. I have, with your help, raised two grown boys. Many's the day I thought I wouldn't be able to go on, but you gave me the strength to see my way clear. Now, Lord, look down on this heavy heart today. I'm trying to raise my son's children in the way they should go, but, oh, Lord, the devil tried to hinder me on every hand. I never thought I'd hear cursing under this roof, but I try to keep dedicated to the glorification of God, and cursing out of the mouths of babes. But you said in the last days, brother would turn against brother, and children against their parents, that there would be a gnashing of teeth and a rending of flesh. Father, forgive this child, I beg you, on bended knee." I was crying loudly now. Mama's voice had risen to a shouting pitch, and I knew that whatever wrong I had committed was extremely serious. She had even left the store untended to take up my case with God. When she finished, we were all crying. She pulled me to her with one hand and hit me only a few times with the switch. The shock of my sin and the emotional release of her prayer had exhausted her. Mama wouldn't talk right then, but later in the evening, I found that my violation lay in using the phrase, "by the way." Mama explained that Jesus was the way, the truth, and the light. And anyone who says, "by the way," is really saying by Jesus or by God, and the Lord's name would not be taken in vain in her house. When Bailey tried to interpret the words with, "white folks use by the way to mean, while we're on the subject," Mama reminded us that white folks' mouths were most in general loose, and their words were an abomination before Christ. 16. Recently, a white woman from Texas, who would quickly describe herself as a liberal, asked me about my hometown. When I told her that in Stamps my grandmother had owned the only Negro general merchandise store since the turn of the century, she exclaimed, "Why, you were a debutante." Ridiculous and even ludicrous, but Negro girls in small southern towns, whether poverty-stricken or just munching along on a few of life's necessities, were given as extensive and irrelevant Preparations for Adulthood has rich white girls shown in magazines. Admittedly, the training was not the same. While white girls learned to waltz and sit gracefully with a teacup balanced on their knees, we were lagging behind, learning the mid-Victorian values with very little money to indulge them. Come and see Edna Lomax spending the little money she made picking cotton on 5 balls of ecru tatting thread. Her fingers are bound to snag the work, and she'll have to repeat the stitches time and time again. But she knows that when she buys the thread. We were required to embroider, and I had trunks full of colored dish towels, pillowcases, runners, and handkerchiefs to my credit. I mastered the art of crocheting and tatting, and there was a lifetime's supply of dainty doilies that would never be used in sachet dresser drawers. It went without saying that all girls could iron and wash, but the finer touches around the home, like setting a table with real silver, baking roasts and cooking vegetables without meat, had to be learned elsewhere, usually at the source of those habits. During my 10th year, a white woman's kitchen became my finishing school. Mrs. Viola Cullinan was a plump woman who lived in a 3-bedroom house somewhere behind the post office. She was singularly unattractive until she smiled, and then the lines around her eyes and mouth, which made her look perpetually dirty, disappeared, and her face looked like the mask of an impish elf. She usually rested her smile until late afternoon, when her women friends dropped by, and Miss Glory, the cook, served them cold drinks on the closed-in porch. The exactness of her house was inhuman. This glass went here and only here. That cup had its place, and it was an act of impudent rebellion to place it anywhere else. At 12 o'clock, the table was set. At 12:15, Mrs. Cullinan sat down to dinner, whether her husband had arrived or not. At 12:16, Miss Glory brought out the food. It took me a week to learn the difference between a salad plate, a bread plate, and a dessert plate. Mrs. Cullinan kept up the tradition of her wealthy parents. She was from Virginia. Miss Glory, who was a descendant of slaves that had worked for the Cullinans, told me her history. She had married beneath her, according to Miss Glory. Her husband's family hadn't had their money very long, and what they had didn't amount to much. As ugly as she was, I thought privately she was lucky to get a husband above or beneath her station. But Miss Glory wouldn't let me say a thing against her mistress. She was very patient with me, however, over the housework. She explained the dishware, silverware, and servants' bells. The large round bowl in which soup was served wasn't a soup bowl. It was a tureen. There were goblets, sherbet glasses, ice cream glasses, wine glasses, green glass coffee cups with matching saucers, and water glasses. I had a glass to drink from, and it sat with Miss Glory's on a separate shelf from the others. Soup spoons, gravy boat, butter knives, salad forks, and carving platter were additions to my vocabulary, and in fact, almost represented a new language. I was fascinated with the novelty, with the fluttering Mrs. Cullinan and her Alice in Wonderland house. Her husband remains in my memory undefined. I lumped him with all the other white men that I had ever seen and tried not to see. On our way home one evening, Miss Glory told me that Mrs. Cullinan couldn't have children. She said that she was too delicate bone. It was hard to imagine bones at all under those layers of fat. Miss Glory went on to say that the doctor had taken out all her lady organs. I reasoned that a pig's organs included the lungs, heart, and liver. So if Mrs. Cullinan was walking around without those essentials, it explained why she drank alcohol out of unmarked bottles. She was keeping herself embalmed. When I spoke to Bailey about it, he agreed that I was right. But he also informed me that Mr. Cullinan had two daughters by a colored lady, and that I knew them very well. He added that the girls were the spitting image of their father. I was unable to remember what he looked like, although I had just left him a few hours before. But I thought of the Coleman girls. They were very light-skinned and certainly didn't look very much like their mother. No one ever mentioned Mr. Coleman. My pity for Mrs. Cullinan preceded me the next morning, like the Cheshire Cat's smile. Those girls, who could have been her daughters, were beautiful. They didn't have to straighten their hair. Even when they were caught in the rain, their braids still hung down straight, like tamed snakes. Their mouths were pouty little Cupid's bows. Mrs. Cullinan didn't know what she missed, or maybe she did. Poor Mrs. Cullinan. For weeks after, I arrived early, left late, and tried very hard to make up for her barrenness. If she had had her own children, she wouldn't have had to ask me to run 1,000 errands from her back door to the back door of her friends. Poor old Mrs. Cullinan. Then one evening, Miss Glory told me to serve the ladies on the porch. After I set the tray down and turned toward the kitchen, one of the women asked, "What's your name, girl?" It was the speckle-faced one. Mrs. Cullinan said, "She doesn't talk much. Her name is Margaret." "Is she dumb?" "No, as I understand it, she can talk when she wants to, but she's usually quiet as a little mouse. Aren't you, Margaret?" I smiled at her. Poor thing. No organs and couldn't even pronounce my name correctly. "She's a sweet little thing, though." "Well, that may be, but the name's too long. I'd never bother myself. I'd call her Mary if I was you." I fumed into the kitchen. That horrible woman would never have the chance to call me Mary, because if I was starving, I would never work for her. I decided I wouldn't pee on her if her heart was on fire. Giggles drifted in off the porch and into Miss Glory's pots. I wondered what they could be laughing about. White folks were so strange. Could they be talking about me? Everybody knew that they stuck together better than the Negroes did. It was possible that Mrs. Cullinan had friends in St. Louis who had heard about a girl from Stamps being in court and wrote to tell her. Maybe she knew about Mr. Freeman. My lunch was in my mouth a second time, and I went outside and relieved myself on the bed of 4 o'clock's. Miss Glory thought I might be coming down with something and told me to go on home, that Mama would give me some herb tea, and she'd explain to her mistress. I realized how foolish I was being before I reached the pond. Of course Mrs. Cullinan didn't know. Otherwise, she wouldn't have given me the 2 nice dresses that Mama cut down, and she certainly wouldn't have called me a sweet little thing. My stomach felt fine, and I didn't mention anything to Mama. That evening I decided to write a poem on being white, fat, old, and without children. It was going to be a tragic ballad. I would have to watch her carefully to capture the essence of her loneliness and pain. The very next day she called me by the wrong name. Miss Glory and I were washing up the lunch dishes when Mrs. Cullinan came to the doorway. "Mary?" Miss Glory asked, "Who?" Mrs. Cullinan, sagging a little, knew, and I knew. "I want Mary to go down to Mrs. Randall's and take her some soup. She's not been feeling well for a few days." Miss Glory's face was a wonder to see. "You mean Margaret?" Ma'am. Her name's Margaret. That's too long. She's Mary from now on. Heat that soup from last night and put it in the china tureen. And Mary, I want you to carry it carefully. Every person I knew had a hellish horror of being called out of his name. It was a dangerous practice to call a Negro anything that could be loosely construed as insulting because of the centuries of their having been called niggers, jigs, dinges, blackbirds, crows, boots, and spooks. Miss Glory had a fleeting second of feeling sorry for me. Then as she handed me the hot tureen, she said, "Don't mind. Don't pay that no mind. Sticks and stones may break your bones, but words, you know." I've been working for her for 20 years. She held the back door open for me. 20 years. I wasn't much older than you. My name used to be Hallelujah. That's what Ma named me. But my mistress gave me Glory, and it stuck. I likes it better, too. I was in the little path that ran behind the houses when Miss Glory shouted, "It's shorter, too." For a few seconds, it was a toss-up over whether I would laugh, imagine being named Hallelujah, or cry. Imagine letting some white woman rename you for her convenience. My anger saved me from either outburst. I had to quit the job. But the problem was going to be how to do it. Mama wouldn't allow me to quit for just any reason. "She's a peach. That woman is a real peach," Mrs. Randall's maid was talking as she took the soup from me. And I wondered what her name used to be and what she answered to now. For a week, I looked into Mrs. Cullinan's face as she called me Mary. She ignored my coming late and leaving early. Miss Glory was a little annoyed because I had begun to leave egg yolk on the dishes and wasn't putting much heart in polishing the silver. I hoped that she would complain to our boss, but she didn't. Then Bailey solved my dilemma. He had me describe the contents of the cupboard and the particular plates she liked best. Her favorite piece was a casserole shaped like a fish, and the green glass coffee cups. I kept his instructions in mind. So the next day, when Miss Glory was hanging out clothes, and I had again been told to serve the old biddies on the porch, I dropped the empty serving tray. When I heard Mrs. Cullinan scream, "Mary!" I picked up the casserole and two of the green glass cups in readiness. As she rounded the kitchen door, I let them fall on the tiled floor. I could never absolutely describe to Bailey what happened next, because each time I got to the part where she fell on the floor and screwed up her ugly face to cry, we burst out laughing. She actually wobbled around on the floor and picked up shards of cups and cried, "Oh, Mama! Oh, dear God! It's Mama's china from Virginia. Oh, Mama, I'm sorry." Miss Glory came running in from the yard, and the women from the porch crowded around. Miss Glory was almost as broken up as her mistress. "You mean to say she broke our Virginia dishes? What we gonna do?" Mrs. Cullinan cried louder. "That clumsy nigger! Clumsy little black nigger!" Old Speckleface leaned down and asked, "Who did it, Viola? Was it Mary? Who did it?" Everything was happening so fast I can't remember whether her action preceded her words, but I know that Mrs. Cullinan said, "Her name is Margaret, goddammit! Her name's Margaret." And she threw a wedge of the broken plate at me. It could have been hysteria which put her aim off, but the flying crockery caught Miss Glory right over her ear, and she started screaming. I left the front door wide open so all the neighbors could hear. Mrs. Cullinan was right about one thing. My name wasn't Mary. 17. Weekdays revolved on a sameness wheel. they turn into themselves so steadily and inevitably that each seemed to be the original of yesterday's rough draft. Saturdays, however, always broke the mold and dared to be different. Farmers trekked into town with their children and wives streaming around them. Their bored, stiff khaki pants and shirts revealed the painstaking care of a dutiful daughter or wife. They often stopped at the store to get change for bills so they could give out jangling coins to their children, who shook with their eagerness to get to town. The young kids openly resented their parents dawdling in the store, and Uncle Willie would call them in and spread among them bits of sweet peanut patties that had been broken in shipping. They gobbled down the candies and were out again, kicking up the powdery dust in the road and worrying if there was going to be time to get to town at all. Bailey played mumbly peg with the older boys around the chinaberry tree, and Mama and Uncle Willie listened to the farmer's latest news of the country. I thought of myself as hanging in the store, a mote imprisoned on a shaft of sunlight, pushed and pulled by the slightest shift of air, but never falling free into the tempting darkness. In the warm months, morning began with a quick wash in unheated well water. The suds were dashed on a plot of ground beside the kitchen door. It was called the bait garden. Bailey raised worms. After prayers, breakfast in summer was usually dry cereal and fresh milk. Then to our chores, which on Saturday included weekday jobs, scrubbing the floors, raking the yards, polishing our shoes for Sunday. Uncle Willie's had to be shined with a biscuit, and attending to the customers who came breathlessly, also in their Saturday hurry. Looking through the years, I marveled that Saturday was my favorite day in the week. What pleasures could have been squeezed between the fan folds of unending tasks? Children's talent to endure stems from their ignorance of alternatives. After our retreat from St. Louis, Mama gave us a weekly allowance, since she seldom dealt with money other than to take it in and to tithe to the church. I supposed that the weekly 10 cents was to tell us that even she realized that a change had come over us, and that our new unfamiliarity caused her to treat us with a strangeness. I usually gave my money to Bailey, who went to the movies nearly every Saturday. He brought back Street and Smith cowboy books for me. One Saturday, Bailey was late coming back from the Rialto. Mama had begun heating water for the Saturday night baths, and all the evening chores were done. Uncle Willie sat in the twilight on the front porch, mumbling, or maybe singing, and smoking a ready-made. It was quite late. Mothers had called in their children from the group games, and fading sounds of, "Yah! Yah! You didn't catch me," still hung and floated into the store. Uncle Willie said, "Sister, better light the light." On Saturdays, we used the electric lights so that last-minute shoppers could look down the hill and see if the store was open. Mama hadn't told me to turn them on because she didn't want to believe that night had fallen hard and Bailey was still out in the ungodly dark. Her apprehension was evident in the hurried movements around the kitchen and in her lonely, fearing eyes. The black woman in the South who raises sons, grandsons, and nephews had her heartstrings tied to a hanging noose. Any break from routine might herald for them unbearable news. For this reason, Southern blacks, until the present generation, could be counted among America's arch conservatives. Like most self-pitying people, I had very little pity for my relatives' anxiety. If something indeed had happened to Bailey, Uncle Willie would always have Mama, and Mama had the store. Then, after all, we weren't their children. But I would be the major loser if Bailey turned up dead, for he was all I claimed, if not all I had. The bath water was steaming on the cooking stove, but Mama was scrubbing the kitchen table for the umpteenth time. Mama, Uncle Willie called, and she jumped. Mama! I waited in the bright lights of the store, jealous that someone had come along and told these strangers something about my brother, and I would be the last to know. Mama, why don't you and Sister walk down to meet him? To my knowledge, Bailey's name hadn't been mentioned for hours, but we all knew whom he meant. Of course, why didn't that occur to me? I wanted to be gone. Mama said, wait a minute, little lady. Go get your sweater and bring me my shawl. It was darker in the road than I thought it would be. Mama swung the flashlight's arc over the path and weeds and scary tree trunks. The night suddenly became enemy territory, and I knew that if my brother was lost in this land, he was forever lost. He was 11 and very smart. That I granted, but after all, he was so small. The bluebeards and tigers and rippers could eat him up before he could scream for help. Mama told me to take the light, and she reached for my hand. Her voice came from a high hill above me, and in the dark my hand was enclosed in hers. I loved her with a rush. She said nothing. No, don't worry. Aw, don't get tender-hearted. Just the gentle pressure of her rough hand conveyed her own concern and assurance to me. We passed houses which I knew well by daylight, but couldn't recollect in the swarthy gloom. Evening, Miss Jenkins, walking and pulling me along. Sister Henderson, anything wrong? That was from an outline, blacker than the night. No, ma'am, not a thing, bless the Lord. By the time she finished speaking, we had left the worried neighbors far behind. Mr. Willie Williams' Dewdrop Inn was bright, with furry red lights in the distance, and the pond's fishy smell enveloped us. Mama's hand tightened and let go, and I saw the small figure plodding along, tired and old mannish, hands in his pockets and head bent. He walked like a man trudging up the hill behind a coffin. Bailey, it jumped out as Mama said, Jew, and I started to run, but her hand caught mine again and became a vise. I pulled, but she yanked me back to her side. We'll walk, just like we've been walking, young lady. There was no chance to warn Bailey that he was dangerously late, that everybody had been worried, and that he should create a good lie, or better, a great one. Mama said, Bailey, Jr., and he looked up without surprise. You know it's night, and you just not getting home? Yes, ma'am. He was empty. Where was his alibi? What you been doing? Nothing. That's all you got to say? Yes, ma'am. All right, young man. We'll see when you get home. She had turned me loose, so I made a grab for Bailey's hand, but he snatched it away. I said, hey, Bail, hoping to remind him that I was his sister and his only friend, but he grumbled something like, leave me alone. Mama didn't turn on the flashlight on the way back, nor did she answer the questioning good evenings that floated around us as we passed the darkened houses. I was confused and frightened. He was going to get a whipping, and maybe he had done something terrible. If he couldn't talk to me, it must have been serious. But there was no air of spent revelry about him. He just seemed sad. I didn't know what to think. Uncle Willie said, getting too big for your britches, huh? You can't come home. You want to worry your grandmother to death? Bailey was so far away, he was beyond fear. Uncle Willie had a leather belt in his good hand, but Bailey didn't notice or didn't care. I'm going to whip you this time. Uncle Willie had only whipped us once before, and then only with a peach tree switch. So maybe now he was going to kill my brother. I screamed and grabbed for the belt, but Mama caught me. Now don't get uppity, miss, lest you want some of the same thing. He got a lesson coming to him. You come on and get your bath. From the kitchen, I heard the belt fall down, dry and raspy, on naked skin. Uncle Willie was gasping for breath, but Bailey made no sound. I was too afraid to splash water or even to cry and take a chance on drowning out Bailey's pleas for help. But the pleas never came, and the whipping was finally over. I lay awake an eternity, waiting for a sign, a whimper, or a whisper from the next room that he was still alive. Just before I fell exhausted into sleep, I heard Bailey. Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take. My last memory of that night was a question. Why is he saying the baby prayer? We had been saying Our Father which art in heaven for years. For days the steward was a strange country, and we were all newly arrived immigrants. Bailey didn't talk, smile, or apologize. His eyes were so vacant, it seemed his soul had flown away. And at meals, I tried to give him the best pieces of meat and the largest portion of dessert, but he turned them down. Then one evening, at the pig pen, he said without warning, "I saw Mother dear." If he said it, it was bound to be the truth. He wouldn't lie to me. I don't think I asked him where or when. In the movies, he laid his head on the wooden railing. It wasn't really her. It was a woman named Kay Francis. She's a white movie star who looks just like Mother dear. There was no difficulty believing that a white movie star looked like our mother and that Bailey had seen her. He told me that the movies were changed each week. But when another picture came to Stamps, starring Kay Francis, he would tell me and we'd go together. He even promised to sit with me. He had stayed late on the previous Saturday to see the film over again. I understood, and understood too, why he couldn't tell Mama or Uncle Willie. She was our mother and belonged to us. She was never mentioned to anyone because we simply didn't have enough of her to share. We had to wait nearly 2 months before Kay Francis returned to Stamps. Bailey's mood had lightened considerably, but he lived in a state of expectation, and it made him more nervous than he was usually. When he told me that the movie would be shown, we went into our best behavior and were the exemplary children that Grandmother deserved and wished to think us. It was a gay light comedy, and Kay Francis wore long-sleeved white silk shirts with big cufflinks. Her bedroom was all satin and flowers and vases, and her maid, who was black, went around saying, "Lawsy, missy," all the time. There was a Negro chauffeur, too, who rolled his eyes and scratched his head, and I wondered how on earth an idiot like that could be trusted with her beautiful cars. The white folks downstairs laughed every few minutes, throwing the discarded snicker up to the Negroes in the buzzard's roost. The sound would jag around in our air for an indecisive second before the balcony's occupants accepted it and sent their own guffaws to riot with it against the walls of the theater. I laughed too, but not at the hateful jokes made on my people. I laughed because, except that she was white, the big movie star looked just like my mother, except that she lived in a big mansion with 1,000 servants. She lived